Chapter 4, Natural Selection. Natural selection, its power compared with man's selection, its power on characters of trifling importance, its power at all ages and on both sexes, sexual selection, on the generality of intercrosses between individuals of the same species, circumstances favorable and unfavorable to natural selection, namely intercrossing, isolation, number of individuals, slow action, extinction caused by natural selection, divergence of character related to the diversity of inhabitants of any small area, and naturalization. Action of natural selection through divergence of character and extinction on the descendants from a common parent. Explains the grouping of all organic beings. How will the struggle for existence, discussed too briefly in the last chapter, act in regard to variation? Can the principle of selection, which we have seen is so potent in the hands of man, apply in nature? I think we shall see that it can act most effectually. Let it be borne in mind, in what an endless number of strange peculiarities our domestic productions, and in a lesser degree those under nature, vary, and how strong the hereditary tendency is. Under domestication, it may be truly said that the whole organization becomes in some degree plastic. Let it be borne in mind how infinitely complex and close-fitting are the mutual relations of all organic beings to each other and to their physical conditions of life. Can it then be thought improbable, seeing that variations useful to man have undoubtedly occurred, that other variations useful in some way to each being in the great and complex battle of life should sometimes occur in the course of thousands of generations? If such do occur, can we doubt, remembering that many more individuals are born than can possibly survive, that individuals having any advantage, however slight, over others, would have the best chance of surviving and of procreating their kind? On the other hand, we may feel sure that any variation in the least degree injurious would be rigidly destroyed. This preservation of favorable variations and the rejection of injurious variations I call natural selection. Variations neither useful nor injurious would not be affected by natural selection and would be left a fluctuating element, as perhaps we see in the species called polymorphic. We shall best understand the probable course of natural selection by taking the case of a country undergoing some physical change, for instance, of climate. The proportional numbers of its inhabitants would almost immediately undergo a change, and some species might become extinct. We may conclude from what we have seen of the intimate and complex manner in which the inhabitants of each country are bound together, that any change in the numerical proportions of some of the inhabitants, independently of the change of climate itself, would most seriously affect many of the others. If a country were open on its borders, new forms would certainly immigrate, and this also would seriously disturb the relations of some of the former inhabitants. Let it be remembered how powerful the influence of a single introduced tree or mammal has been shown to be, but in the case of an island or of a country partly surrounded by barriers, into which new and better adapted forms could not freely enter, we should then have places in the economy of nature which would assuredly be better filled up if some of the original inhabitants were in some manner modified. For, had the area been open to immigration, these same places would have been seized on by intruders. In such case, every slight modification, which in the course of ages chanced to arise, and which in any way favored the individuals of any of the species by better adapting them to their altered conditions, would tend to be preserved. A natural selection would thus have free scope for the work of improvement. We have reason to believe, as stated in the first chapter, that a change in the conditions of life, by specially acting on the reproductive system, causes or increases variability. And in the foregoing case, the conditions of life are supposed to have undergone a change, and this would manifestly be favorable to natural selection by giving a better chance of profitable variations occurring. And unless profitable variations do occur, natural selection can do nothing. Not that, as I believe, any extreme amount of variability is necessary, as man can certainly produce great results by adding up in any given direction mere individual differences, so could nature, but far more easily, from having incomparably longer time at her disposal. Nor do I believe that any great physical change as a planet or any unusual degree of isolation to check immigration is actually necessary to produce new and unoccupied places for natural selection to fill up by modifying and improving some of the varying inhabitants. For as all the inhabitants of each country are struggling together with nicely balanced forces, extremely slight modifications in the structure or habits of one inhabitant would often give it an advantage over others, and still further modifications of the same kind would often still further increase the advantage. No country can be named in which all the native inhabitants are now so perfectly adapted to each other and to the physical conditions under which they live that none of them could anyhow be improved. For in all countries, the natives have been so far conquered by naturalized productions that they have allowed foreigners to take firm possession of the land. And as foreigners have thus everywhere beaten some of the natives, we may safely conclude that the natives might have been modified with advantage, so as to have better resisted such intruders. As man can produce, and certainly has produced a great result by his methodical and unconscious means of selection, what may not nature effect? Man can act only on external and visible characters. Nature cares nothing for appearances, except insofar as they may be useful to any being. She can act on every internal organ, on every shade of constitutional difference, on the whole machinery of life. Man selects only for his own good, nature only for that of the being which she tends. Every selected character is fully exercised by her, and the being is placed under well-suited conditions of life. Man keeps the natives of many climates in the same country. He seldom exercises each selected character in some peculiar and fitting manner. He feeds a long and a short-beaked pigeon on the same food. He does not exercise a long-backed or long-legged quadruped in any peculiar manner. He exposes sheep with long and short wool to the same climate. He does not allow the most vigorous males to struggle for the females. He does not rigidly destroy all inferior animals, but protects, during each varying season, as far as lies in his power, all his productions. He often begins his selection by some half-monstrous form, or at least by some modification prominent enough to catch his eye, or to be plainly useful to him. Under nature, the slightest difference of structure or constitution may well turn the nicely balanced scale in the struggle for life, and so be preserved. How fleeting are the wishes and efforts of man, how short his time, and consequently how poor will his products be compared with those accumulated by nature during whole geological periods. Can we wonder, then, that nature's productions should be far truer in character than man's productions, that they should be infinitely better adapted to the most complex conditions of life, and should plainly bear the stamp of far higher workmanship? It may be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing, throughout the world, every variation, even the slightest, rejecting that which is bad, preserving and adding up all that is good, silently and insensibly working, whenever and wherever opportunity offers, at the improvement of each organic being in relation to its organic and inorganic conditions of life. We see nothing of these slow changes in progress, until the hand of time has marked the long lapses of ages, and then so imperfect is our view into long past geological ages that we only see that the forms of life are now different from what they formerly were. Although natural selection can act only through and for the good of each being, yet characters and structures, which we are apt to consider as of very trifling importance, may thus be acted on. When we see leaf-eating insects green and bark feeders mottled grey, the alpine ptarmigan, white in winter, the red grouse, the colour of heather, and the black grouse, that of peaty earth. We must believe that these tints are of service to these birds and insects in preserving them from danger. Grouse, if not destroyed at some period of their lives, would increase in countless numbers. They are known to suffer largely from birds of prey, and hawks are guided by eyesight to their prey. So much so that on parts of the continent, persons are warned not to keep white pigeons as being the most liable to destruction. Hence, I can see no reason to doubt that natural selection might be most effective in giving the proper colour to each kind of grass, and in keeping that colour, when once acquired, true and constant. Nor ought we to think that the occasional destruction of an animal of any particular colour would produce little effect. We should remember how essential it is in a flock of white sheep to destroy every lamb with the faintest trace of black. In plants, the down on the fruit and the colour of the flesh are considered by botanists as characters of the most trifling importance. Yet, we hear from an excellent horticulturist, Downing, that in the United States, smooth-skinned fruits suffer far more from a beetle, a curculio, than those with down. The purple plums suffer far more from a certain disease than yellow plums, whereas another disease attacks yellow-fleshed peaches far more than those with other colored flesh. If, with all the aids of art, these slight differences make a great difference in cultivating the several varieties, assuredly in a state of nature where the trees would have to struggle with other trees and with a host of enemies, such differences would effectually settle which variety, whether a smooth or downy, a yellow or purple fleshed fruit, should succeed. In looking at many small points of difference between species, which, as far as our ignorance permits us to judge, seem to be quite unimportant, we must not forget that climate, food, etc., probably produce some slight and direct effect. It is, however, far more necessary to bear in mind that there are many unknown laws of correlation of growth, which, when one part of the organization is modified through variation, and the modifications are accumulated by natural selection for the good of the being, will cause other modifications, often of the most unexpected nature. As we see that those variations which, under domestication, appear at any particular period of life, tend to reappear in the offspring at the same period. For instance, in the seeds of the many varieties of our culinary and agricultural plants, in the caterpillar and cocoon stages of the varieties of the silkworm, in the eggs of poultry and in the colour of the down of their chickens, in the horns of our sheep and cattle when nearly adult. So, in a state of nature, natural selection will be enabled to act on and modify organic beings at any age by the accumulation of profitable variations at that age and by their inheritance at the corresponding age. If it profit a plant to have its seeds more and more widely disseminated by the wind, I can see no greater difficulty in this being affected through natural selection than in the cotton planter, increasing and improving by selection the down in the pods on his cotton trees. Natural selection may modify and adapt the larva of an insect to a score of contingencies wholly different from those which concern a mature insect. These modifications will no doubt affect, through the laws of correlation, the structure of the adult, and probably in the case of those insects which live only for a few hours and which never feed, a large part of their structure is merely the correlated result of successive changes in the structure of their larvae. So, conversely, modifications in the adult will probably often affect the structure of the larva. But in all cases, natural selection will ensure that modifications consequent on other modifications at a different period of life shall not be in the least degree injurious. For if they became so, they would cause the extinction of the species. Natural selection will modify the structure of the young in relation to the parent, and of the parent in relation to the young. In social animals, it will adapt the structure of each individual for the benefit of the community, if each in consequence profits by the selected change. What natural selection cannot do is to modify the structure of one species without giving it any advantage for the good of another species. And though statements to this effect may be found in works of natural history, I cannot find one case which will bear investigation. A structure used only once in an animal's whole life, if of high importance to it, might be modified to any extent by natural selection. For instance, the great jaws possessed by certain insects and used exclusively for opening the cocoon, or the hard tip to the beak of nestling birds used for breaking the egg. It has been asserted that of the best short-beaked tumbler pigeons, more perish in the egg than are able to get out of it, so that fanciers assist in the act of hatching. Now, if nature had to make the beak of a full-grown pigeon very short for the bird's own advantage, the process of modification would be very slow, and there would be simultaneously the most rigorous selection of the young birds within the egg, which had the most powerful and hardest beaks, for all with weak beaks would inevitably perish. Or more delicate and more easily broken shells might be selected, the thickness of the shell being known to vary like every other structure. Sexual selection. Inasmuch as peculiarities often appear under domestication in one sex and become hereditarily attached to that sex, the same fact probably occurs under nature, and if so, natural selection will be able to modify one sex in its functional relations to the other sex, or in relation to wholly different habits of life in the two sexes, as is sometimes the case with insects. And this leads me to say a few words on what I call sexual selection. This depends not on a struggle for existence, but on a struggle between the males for possession of the female. The result is not death to the unsuccessful competitor, but few or no offspring. Sexual selection is therefore less rigorous than natural selection. Generally, the most vigorous males, those which are best fitted for their places in nature, will leave most progeny. But in many cases, victory will depend not on general vigor, but on having special weapons confined to the male sex. A hornless stag or spurless cock would have a poor chance of leaving offspring. Sexual selection, by always allowing the victor to breed, might surely give indomitable courage, length to the spur, and strength to the wing to strike in the spurred leg, as well as the brutal cockfighter, who knows well that he can improve his breed by careful selection of the best cock. How low in the scale of nature this law of battle descends, I know not. Male alligators have been described as fighting, bellowing, and whirling round like Indians in a war dance for the possession of the females. Male salmons have been seen fighting all day long. Male stag beetles often bear wounds from the huge mandibles of other males. The war is perhaps severest between the males of polygamous animals, and these seem oftenest provided with special weapons. The males of carnivorous animals are already well armed, though to them and to others, special means of defense may be given through means of sexual selection, as the mane to the lion, the shoulder pad to the boar, and the hooked jaw to the male salmon. For the shield may be as important for victory as the sword or spear. Amongst birds, the contest is often of a more peaceful character. All those who have attended to the subject believe that there is the severest rivalry between the males of many species to attract by singing the females. The rock thrush of Guyana, birds of paradise, and some others congregate. And successive males display their gorgeous plumage and perform strange antics before the females, which, standing by as spectators, at last choose the most attractive partner. Those who have closely attended to birds in confinement well know that they often take individual preferences and dislikes. Thus, Sir R. Heron has described how one pied peacock was eminently attractive to all his hen birds. It may appear childish to attribute any effect to such apparently weak means. I cannot here enter on the details necessary to support this view. But if man can in a short time give elegant carriage and beauty to his bantams, according to his standard of beauty, I can see no good reason to doubt that female birds, by selecting, during thousands of generations, the most melodious or beautiful males, according to their standard of beauty, might produce a marked effect. I strongly suspect that some well-known laws with respect to the plumage of male and female birds, in comparison with the plumage of the young, can be explained on the view of plumage having been chiefly modified by sexual selection, acting when the birds have come to the breeding age or during the breeding season. The modifications thus produced being inherited at corresponding ages or seasons, either by the males alone or by the males and females. But I have not space here to enter on this subject. Thus it is, as I believe, that when the males and females of any animal have the same general habits of life, but differ in structure, color, or ornament, such differences have been mainly caused by sexual selection. That is, individual males have had, in successive generations, some slight advantage over other males in their weapons, means of defense, or charms, and have transmitted these advantages to their male offspring. Yet, I would not wish to attribute all such sexual differences to this agency, for we see peculiarities arising and becoming attached to the male sex in our domestic animals, as the wattle in male carriers, horn-like protuberances in the cocks of certain fowls, etc., which we cannot believe to be either useful to the males in battle or attractive to the females. We see analogous cases under nature. For instance, the tuft of hair on the breast of a turkey cock, which can hardly be either useful or ornamental to this bird. Indeed, had the tuft appeared under domestication, it would have been called a monstrosity. Illustrations of the action of natural selection. In order to make it clear how, as I believe, natural selection acts, I must beg permission to give one or two imaginary illustrations. Let us take the case of a wolf, which preys on various animals, securing some by craft, some by strength, and some by fleetness. And let us suppose that the fleetest prey, a deer, for instance, had from any change in the country increased in numbers, or that other prey had decreased in numbers during that season of the year when the wolf is hardest pressed for food. I can, under such circumstances, see no reason to doubt that the swiftest and slimmest wolves would have the best chance of surviving, and so be preserved or selected, provided always that they retain strength to master their prey at this or at some other period of the year when they might be compelled to prey on other animals. I can see no more reason to doubt this than that man can improve the fleetness of his greyhounds by careful and methodical selection, or by that unconscious selection which results from each man trying to keep the best dogs without any thought of modifying the breed. Even without any change in the proportional numbers of the animals on which our wolf preyed, a cub might be born with an innate tendency to pursue certain kinds of prey. Nor can this be thought very improbable, for we often observe great differences in the natural tendencies of our domestic animals. One cat, for instance, taking to catch rats. Another mice. One cat, according to Mr. St. John, bringing home winged game, another hares or rabbits, and another hunting on marshy ground and almost nightly catching woodcocks or snipes. The tendency to catch rats rather than mice is known to be inherited. Now, if any slight innate change of habit or of structure benefited an individual wolf, it would have the best chance of surviving and of leaving offspring. Some of its young would probably inherit the same habits or structure, and by the repetition of this process, a new variety might be formed, which would either supplant or coexist with the parent form of wolf. Or again, the wolves inhabiting a mountainous district and those frequenting the lowlands would naturally be forced to hunt different prey, and from the continued preservation of the individuals best fitted for the two sites, two varieties might slowly be formed. These varieties would cross and blend where they met, but to this subject of intercrossing, we shall soon have to return. I may add that, according to Mr. Pierce, There are two varieties of the wolf inhabiting the Catskill Mountains in the United States. One with a light greyhound-like form, which pursues deer, and the other more bulky, with shorter legs, which more frequently attacks the shepherd's flock. Let us now take a more complex case. Certain plants excrete a sweet juice, apparently for the sake of eliminating something injurious from their sap. This is effected by glands at the base of the stipules in some leguminosae and at the back of the leaf of the common laurel. This juice, though small in quantity, is greedily sought by insects. Let us now suppose a little sweet juice or nectar to be excreted by the inner bases of the petals of a flower. In this case, insects, in seeking the nectar, would get dusted with pollen and would certainly often transport the pollen from one flower to the stigma of another flower. The flowers of two distinct individuals of the same species would thus get crossed, and the act of crossing, we have good reason to believe, as will hereafter be more fully alluded to, would produce very vigorous seedlings, which consequently would have the best chance of flourishing and surviving. Some of these seedlings would probably inherit the nectar excreting power. Those individual flowers which had the largest glands, or nectaries, and which excreted most nectar, would be oftenest visited by insects, and would be oftenest crossed, and so in the long run would gain the upper hand. Those flowers also which had their stamens and pistils placed in relation to the size and habits of the particular insects which visited them, so as to favour in any degree the transportal of their pollen from flower to flower, would likewise be favoured or selected. We might have taken the case of insects visiting flowers for the sake of collecting pollen instead of nectar, and as pollen is formed for the sole object of fertilisation, its destruction appears a simple loss to the plant. Yet, if a little pollen were carried, at first occasionally and then habitually, by the pollen-devouring insects from flower to flower, and a cross thus effected, although 9/10 of the pollen were destroyed, it might still be a great gain to the plant. And those individuals which produced more and more pollen and had larger and larger anthers would be selected. When our plant, by this process of the continued preservation or natural selection of more and more attractive flowers, had been rendered highly attractive to insects, they would, unintentionally on their part, regularly carry pollen from flower to flower, and that they can most effectually do this, I could easily show by many striking instances. I will give only one, not as a very striking case, but as likewise illustrating one step in the separation of the sexes of plants, presently to be alluded to. Some holly trees bear only male flowers, which have four stamens producing rather a small quantity of pollen, and a rudimentary pistil. Other holly trees bear only female flowers. These have a full-sized pistil and four stamens with shriveled anthers, in which not a grain of pollen can be detected. Having found a female tree exactly 60 yards from a male tree, I put the stigmas of 20 flowers, taken from different branches, under the microscope, and on all, without exception, there were pollen grains, and on some a profusion of pollen. As the wind had set for several days from the female to the male tree, the pollen could not thus have been carried. The weather had been cold and boisterous, and therefore not favourable to bees. Nevertheless, every female flower which I examined had been effectually fertilised by the bees, accidentally dusted with pollen, having flown from tree to tree in search of nectar. But to return to our imaginary case, as soon as the plant had been rendered so highly attractive to insects that pollen was regularly carried from flower to flower, another process might commence. No naturalist doubts the advantage of what has been called the physiological division of labour. Hence, we may believe that it would be advantageous for a plant to produce stamens alone in one flower or on one whole plant, and pistils alone in another flower, or on another plant. In plants under culture and placed under new conditions of life, sometimes the male organs and sometimes the female organs become more or less impotent, Now, if we suppose this to occur in ever so slight a degree under nature, then as pollen is already carried regularly from flower to flower, and as a more complete separation of the sexes of our plant would be advantageous on the principle of the division of labor, individuals with this tendency more and more increased would be continually favored or selected, until at last a complete separation of the sexes would be effected. Let us now turn to the nectar-feeding insects in our imaginary case. We may suppose the plant, of which we have been slowly increasing the nectar by continued selection, to be a common plant, and that certain insects depended in main part on its nectar for food. I could give many facts showing how anxious bees are to save time. For instance, their habit of cutting holes and sucking the nectar at the bases of certain flowers, which they can, with a very little more trouble, enter by the mouth. Bearing such facts in mind, I can see no reason to doubt that an accidental deviation in the size and form of the body, or in the curvature and length of the proboscis, etc., far too slight to be appreciated by us, might profit a bee or other insect, so that an individual so characterized would be able to obtain its food more quickly, and so have a better chance of living and leaving descendants. Its descendants would probably inherit a tendency to a similar slight deviation of structure. The tubes of the corollas of the common red and incarnate clovers, Trifolium patense and incarnatum, do not, on a hasty glance, appear to differ in length. Yet, a hive bee can easily suck the nectar out of the incarnate clover, but not out of the common red clover, which is visited by humble bees alone. So that whole fields of the red clover offer in vain an abundant supply of precious nectar to the hive bee. Thus, it might be a great advantage to the hive bee to have a slightly longer or differently constructed proboscis. On the other hand, I have found, by experimenting, that the fertility of clover greatly depends on bees visiting and moving parts of the corolla so as to push the pollen onto the stigmatic surface. Hence, again, if humble bees were to become rare in any country, it might be a great advantage to the red clover to have a shorter or more deeply divided tube to its corolla, so that the hive bee could visit its flowers. Thus I can understand how a flower and a bee might slowly become, either simultaneously or one after the other, modified and adapted in the most perfect manner to each other, by the continued preservation of individuals presenting neutral and slightly favorable deviations of structure. I am well aware that this doctrine of natural selection, exemplified in the above imaginary instances, is open to the same objections which were at first urged against Sir Charles Lyell's noble views on the modern changes of the earth as illustrative of geology. But we now very seldom hear the action, for instance, of the coast waves, called a trifling and insignificant cause, when applied to the excavation of gigantic valleys or to the formation of the longest lines of inland cliffs. Natural selection can act only by the preservation and accumulation of infinitesimally small inherited modifications, each profitable to the preserved being. And as modern geology has almost banished such views as the excavation of a great valley by a single diluvial wave, so will natural selection, if it be a true principle, banish the belief of the continued creation of new organic beings, or of any great and sudden modification in their structure. On the intercrossing of individuals, I must here introduce a short digression. In the case of animals and plants with separated sexes, it is of course obvious that two individuals must always unite for each birth. But in the case of hermaphrodites, this is far from obvious. Nevertheless, I am strongly inclined to believe that with all hermaphrodites, two individuals, either occasionally or habitually, concur for the reproduction of their kind. This view, I may add, was first suggested by Andrew Knight. We shall presently see its importance, but I must here treat the subject with extreme brevity, though I have the materials prepared for an ample discussion. all vertebrate animals, all insects, and some other large groups of animals pair for each birth. Modern research has much diminished the number of supposed hermaphrodites, and of real hermaphrodites, a large number pair. That is, two individuals regularly unite for reproduction, which is all that concerns us. But still there are many hermaphrodite animals which certainly do not habitually pair, and the vast majority of plants are hermaphrodites. What reason, it may be asked, is there for supposing in these cases that two individuals ever concur in reproduction? As it is impossible here to enter on details, I must pass to some general considerations alone. In the first place, I have collected so large a body of facts, showing, in accordance with the almost universal belief of breeders, that with animals and plants, a cross between different varieties, or between individuals of the same variety but of another strain, gives vigor and fertility to the offspring. And on the other hand, that close interbreeding diminishes vigor and fertility. But these facts alone incline me to believe that it is a general law of nature, utterly ignorant though we be of the meaning of the law, that no organic being self-fertilizes itself for an eternity of generations, but that a cross with another individual is occasionally, perhaps at very long intervals, indispensable. On the belief that this is a law of nature, we can, I think, understand several large classes of facts, such as the following, which on any other view are inexplicable. Every hybridizer knows how unfavorable exposure to wet is to the fertilization of a flower. Yet, what a multitude of flowers have their anthers and stigmas fully exposed to the weather. But if an occasional cross be indispensable, the fullest freedom for the entrance of pollen from another individual will explain this state of exposure, more especially as the plant's own anthers and pistils generally stand so close together that self-fertilization seems almost inevitable. Many flowers, on the other hand, have their organs of fructification closely enclosed, as in the great Papilionaceous or pea family. But in several, perhaps in all, such flowers, there is a very curious adaptation between the structure of the flower and the manner in which bees suck the nectar, for in doing this they either push the flower's own pollen on the stigma or bring pollen from another flower. So necessary are the visits of bees to papilionaceous flowers, but I have found, by experiments published elsewhere, that their fertility is greatly diminished if these visits be prevented. Now, it is scarcely possible that bees should fly from flower to flower and not carry pollen from one to the other to the great good, as I believe, of the plant. Bees will act like a camel hair pencil, and it is quite sufficient just to touch the anthers of one flower and then the stigma of another with the same brush to ensure fertilization. But it must not be supposed that bees would thus produce a multitude of hybrids between distinct species. For if you bring on the same brush a plant's own pollen and pollen from another species, the former will have such a prepotent effect that it will invariably and completely destroy, as has been shown by Geffner, any influence from the foreign pollen. When the stamens of a flower suddenly spring towards the pistil or slowly move one after the other towards it, the contrivance seems adapted solely to ensure self-fertilization. And, no doubt, it is useful for this end, but the agency of insects is often required to cause the stamens to spring forward, as Kerleuter has shown to be the case with the barberry. And curiously, in this very genius, which seems to have a special contrivance for self-fertilization, it is well known that if very closely allied forms or varieties are planted near each other, it is hardly possible to raise pure seedlings, so largely do they naturally cross. In many other cases, far from there being any aids for self-fertilization, there are special contrivances, as I could show from the writings of C.C. Sprengel, and from my own observations, which effectually prevent the stigma receiving pollen from its own flower, For instance, in Lobelia Pulgens, there is a really beautiful and elaborate contrivance by which every one of the infinitely numerous pollen granules are swept out of the conjoined anthers of each flower before the stigma of that individual flower is ready to receive them. And as this flower is never visited, at least in my garden, by insects, it never sets a seed. Thereby placing pollen from one flower on the stigma of another, I raise plenty of seedlings. And whilst another species of Lobelia growing closer by, which is visited by bees, seeds freely. In very many other cases, though there be no special mechanical contrivance to prevent the stigma of a flower receiving its own pollen, yet, as C.T. Sprengel has shown, and as I can confirm, either the anthers burst before the stigma is ready for fertilization, or the stigma is ready before the pollen of that flower is ready. So that these plants have in fact separated sexes and must habitually be crossed. How strange are these facts? How strange that the pollen and stigmatic surface of the same flower, though placed so close together, as if for the very purpose of self-fertilization, should in so many cases be mutually useless to each other. How simply are these facts explained on the view of an occasional cross with a distinct individual being advantageous or indispensable? If several varieties of the cabbage, radish, onion, and of some other plants be allowed to seed near each other, a large majority, as I have found, of the seedlings thus raised will turn out mongrels. For instance, I raised 233 seedling cabbages from some plants of different varieties growing near each other, and of these, only 78 were true to their kind, and some even of these were not perfectly true. Yet the pistil of each cabbage flower is surrounded not only by its own six stamens, but by those of the many other flowers on the same plant. How then comes it that such a vast number of the seedlings are mongrelized? I suspect that it must arise from the pollen of a distinct variety, having a prepotent effect over a flower's own pollen, and that this is part of the general law of good being derived from the intercrossing of distinct individuals of the same species. When distinct species are crossed, the case is directly the reverse, for a plant's own pollen is always prepotent over foreign pollen, but to this subject we shall return in a future chapter. In the case of a gigantic tree covered with innumerable flowers, it may be objected that pollen could seldom be carried from tree to tree, and at most only from flower to flower on the same tree, and that flowers on the same tree can be considered as distinct individuals only in a limited sense. I believe this objection to be valid, but that nature has largely provided against it by giving to trees a strong tendency to bear flowers with separated sexes. When the sexes are separated, although the male and female flowers may be produced on the same tree, we can see that pollen must be regularly carried from flower to flower, and this will give a better chance of pollen being occasionally carried from tree to tree. That trees belonging to all orders have their sexes more often separated than other plants, I find to be the case in this country. And at my request, Dr. Hooker tabulated the trees of New Zealand, and Dr. Asa Gray those of the United States. And the result was as I anticipated. On the other hand, Dr. Hooker has recently informed me that he finds that the rule does not hold in Australia, and I have made these few remarks on the sexes of trees simply to call attention to the subject. Turning, for a very brief space, to animals. On the land, there are some hermaphrodites, as land mollusca and earthworms, but these all pair, as yet I have not found a single case of a terrestrial animal which fertilizes itself. We can understand this remarkable fact, which offers so strong a contrast with terrestrial plants, on the view of an occasional cross being indispensable, by considering the medium in which terrestrial animals live and the nature of the fertilizing element. For we know of no means analogous to the action of insects and of the wind in the case of plants, by which an occasional cross could be effected with terrestrial animals without the concurrence of two individuals. of aquatic animals that are many, self-fertilizing hermaphrodites. But here, currents in the water offer an obvious means for an occasional cross. And as in the case of flowers, I have as yet failed, after consultation with one of the highest authorities, namely Professor Huxley, to discover a single case of an hermaphrodite animal with the organs of reproduction so perfectly enclosed within the body that access from without and the occasional influence of a distinct individual can be shown to be physically impossible. Cirripedes long appeared to me to present a case of very great difficulty under this point of view, but I have been enabled, by a fortunate chance, elsewhere to prove that two individuals, though both are self-fertilizing hermaphrodites, do sometimes cross. It must have struck most naturalists as a strange anomaly that, in the case of both animals and plants, species of the same family, and even of the same genus, though agreeing closely with each other in almost their whole organization, yet are not really, some of them hermaphrodites, and some of them unisexual. But if, in fact, all hermaphrodites do occasionally intercross with other individuals, the difference between hermaphrodites and unisexual species, as far as function is concerned, becomes very small. From these several considerations, and from the many special facts which I have collected, but which I am not here able to give, I'm strongly inclined to suspect that both in the vegetable and animal kingdoms, an occasional intercourse with a distinct individual is a law of nature. I'm well aware that there are, on this view, many cases of difficulty, some of which I am trying to investigate. Finally, then, we may conclude that in many organic beings, a cross between two individuals is an obvious necessity for each birth. In many others, it occurs perhaps only at long intervals, but in none, as I suspect, can self-fertilization go on for perpetuity. Circumstances favorable to natural selection. This is an extremely intricate subject. A large amount of inheritable and diversified variability is favorable, but I believe mere individual differences suffice for the work. A large number of individuals, by giving a better chance for the appearance within any given period of profitable variations, will compensate for a lesser amount of variability in each individual, and is, I believe, an extremely important element of success. Though nature grants vast periods of time for the work of natural selection, she does not grant an indefinite period. For as all organic beings are striving, it may be said, to seize on each place in the economy of nature, if any one species does not become modified and improved in a corresponding degree with its competitors, it will soon be exterminated. In man's methodical selection, a breeder selects for some definite object, and free intercrossing will wholly stop his work. But when many men, without intending to alter the breed, have a nearly common standard of perfection, and all try to get and breed from the best animals, much improvement and modification surely but slowly follow from this unconscious process of selection, notwithstanding a large amount of crossing with inferior animals. Thus it will be in nature, for within a confined area, with some place in its polity not so perfectly occupied as might be, natural selection will always tend to preserve all the individuals varying in the right direction, though in different degrees, so as better to fill up the unoccupied place. But if the area be large, its several districts will almost certainly present different conditions of life. And then, if natural selection be modifying and improving a species in the several districts, there will be intercrossing with the other individuals of the same species on the confines of each. And in this case, the effect of intercrossing can hardly be counterbalanced by natural selection, always tending to modify all the individuals in each district in exactly the same manner to the conditions of each. For in a continuous area, the conditions will generally graduate away insensibly from one district to another. The intercrossing will most affect those animals which unite for each birth, which wander much, and which do not breed at a very quick rate. Hence, in animals of this nature, for instance in birds, varieties will generally be confined to separated countries. And this I believe to be the case. In hermaphrodite organisms, which cross only occasionally, and likewise in animals which unite for each birth, but which wander little and which can increase at a very rapid rate, a new and improved variety might be quickly formed on any one spot, and might there maintain itself in a body, so that whatever intercrossing took place would be chiefly between the individuals of the same new variety. A local variety, when once thus formed, might subsequently slowly spread to other districts. On the above principle, nurserymen always prefer getting seed from a large body of plants of the same variety, as the chance of intercrossing with other varieties is thus lessened. Even in the case of slow-breeding animals, which unite for each birth, we must not overrate the effect of intercrosses in retarding natural selection. For I can bring a considerable catalogue of facts showing that within the same area, varieties of the same animal can long remain distinct, from haunting different stations, from breeding at slightly different seasons, or from varieties of the same kind preferring to pair together. Intercrossing plays a very important part in nature in keeping the individuals of the same species or of the same variety true and uniform in character. It will obviously thus act far more efficiently with those animals which unite for each birth. But I have already attempted to show that we have reason to believe that occasional intercrosses take place with all animals and with all plants. Even if these take place only at long intervals, I am convinced that the young thus produced will gain so much in vigor and fertility over the offspring from long-continued self-fertilization that they will have a better chance of surviving and propagating their kind. And thus, in the long run, the influence of intercrosses, even at rare intervals, will be great. If there exist organic beings which never intercross, uniformity of character can be retained amongst them, as long as their conditions of life remain the same, only through the principle of inheritance, and through natural selection destroying any which depart from the proper type. But if their conditions of life change, and they undergo modification, uniformity of character can be given to their modified offspring solely by natural selection preserving the same favorable variations. Isolation, also, is an important element in the process of natural selection. In a confined or isolated area, if not very large, the organic and inorganic conditions of life will generally be in a great degree uniform, so that natural selection will tend to modify all the individuals of a varying species throughout the area in the same manner in relation to the same condition. Intercrosses, also, with the individuals of the same species, which otherwise would have inhabited the surrounding and differently circumstanced districts, will be prevented. But isolation probably acts more efficiently in checking the immigration of better adapted organisms after any physical change, such as of climate or elevation of the land, etc. And thus, new places in the natural economy of the country are left open for the old inhabitants to struggle for and become adapted to, through modifications in their structure and constitution. Lastly, isolation, by checking immigration and consequently competition, will give time for any new variety to be slowly improved, and this may sometimes be of importance in the production of new species. If, however, an isolated area be very small, either from being surrounded by barriers or from having very peculiar physical conditions, the total number of the individuals supported on it will necessarily be very small, and fewness of individuals will greatly retard the production of new species through natural selection by decreasing the chance of the appearance of favorable variation. If we turn to nature to test the truth of these remarks and look at any small isolated area, such as an oceanic island, although the total number of the species inhabiting it will be found to be small, as we shall see in our chapter on geographical distribution, yet of these species, a very large proportion are endemic that is, have been produced there nowhere else. Hence, an oceanic island at first sight seems to have been highly favorable for the production of new species. But we may thus greatly deceive ourselves, for to ascertain whether a small isolated area or a large open area like a continent has been most favorable for the production of new organic forms, we ought to make a comparison within equal time, and this we are incapable of doing. Although I do not doubt that isolation is of considerable importance in the production of new species, on the whole, I am inclined to believe that largeness of area is of more importance, more especially in the production of species which will prove capable of enduring for a long period and of spreading widely. Throughout a great and open area, not only will there be a better chance of favorable variations arising from the large number of individuals of the same species there supported, but the conditions of life are infinitely complex from the large number of already existing species. And if some of these many species become modified and improved, others will have to be improved in a corresponding degree, or they will be exterminated. Each new form also, as soon as it has been much improved, will be able to spread over the open and continuous area and will thus come into competition with many others. Hence, more new places will be formed, and the competition to fill them will be more severe on a large than on a small and isolated area. Moreover, great areas, though now continuous, owing to oscillations of level, will often have recently existed in a broken condition, so that the good effects of isolation will generally, to a certain extent, have concurred. Finally, I conclude that although small isolated areas probably have been, in some respects, highly favorable for the production of new species, yet that the course of modification will generally have been more rapid on large areas. And what is more important, that the new forms produced on large areas, which already have been victorious over many competitors, will be those that will spread most widely, will give rise to most new varieties and species, and will thus play an important part in the changing history of the organic world. We can, perhaps, on these views, understand some facts, which will be again alluded to in our chapter on geographical distribution. For instance, that the productions of the smaller continent of Australia have formerly yielded, and apparently are now yielding, before those of the larger Europeo-Asiatic area. Thus, also it is that continental productions have everywhere become so largely naturalized on islands. On a small island, the race for life will have been less severe, and there will have been less modification and less extermination. Hence, perhaps, it comes that the flora of Madeira, according to Oswald Hare, resembles the extinct tertiary flora of Europe. All freshwater basins taken together make a small area compared with that of the sea or of the land, and consequently the competition between freshwater productions will have been less severe than elsewhere. New forms will have been more slowly formed, and old forms more slowly exterminated. And it is in freshwater that we find 7 genera of gamoid fishes, remnants of a once preponderant order. And in freshwater we find some of the most anomalous forms now known in the world, as the Ornithorhynchus and Lepidosiren, which, like fossils, connect to a certain extent orders now widely separated in the natural scale. These anomalous forms may almost be called living fossils. They have endured to the present day from having inhabited a confined area and from having thus been exposed to less severe competition. To sum up, the circumstances favorable and unfavorable to natural selection, as far as the extreme intricacy of the subject permits, I conclude, looking to the future, that for terrestrial productions, a large continental area, which will probably undergo many oscillations of level, and which consequently will exist for long periods in a broken condition, will be the most favorable for the production of many new forms of life, likely to endure long and to spread widely. For the area will first have existed as a continent, and the inhabitants, at this period numerous in individuals and kinds, will have been subjected to very severe competition. When converted by subsidence into large separate islands, there will still exist many individuals of the same species on each island. Intercrossing on the confines of the range of each species will thus be checked. After physical changes of any kind, immigration will be prevented, so that new places in the polity of each island will have to be filled up by modifications of the old inhabitants. And time will be allowed for the varieties in each to become well modified and perfected. When, by renewed elevation, the island shall be reconverted into a continental area, there will again be severe competition. The most favored or improved varieties will be enabled to spread. There will be much extinction of the less improved forms, and the relative proportional numbers of the various inhabitants of the renewed continent will again be changed. And again, there will be a fair field for natural selection to improve still further the inhabitants and thus produce new species. That natural selection will always act with extreme slowness, I fully admit. Its action depends on there being places in the polity of nature which can be better occupied by some of the inhabitants of the country undergoing modification of some kind. The existence of such places will often depend on physical changes, which are generally very slow, and on the immigration of better adapted forms having been checked. But the action of natural selection will probably still oftener depend on some of the inhabitants becoming slowly modified, the mutual relations of many of the other inhabitants being thus disturbed. Nothing can be effected unless favorable variations occur, and variation itself is apparently always a very slow process. The process will often be greatly retarded by pre-intercrossing. Many will exclaim that these several causes are amply sufficient wholly to stop the action of natural selection. I do not believe so. On the other hand, I do believe that natural selection will always act very slowly, often only at long intervals of time, and generally on only a very few of the inhabitants of the same region at the same time. I further believe that this very slow, intermittent action of natural selection accords perfectly well with what geology tells us of the rate and manner at which the inhabitants of this world have changed. Slow though the process of selection may be, if feeble man can do much by his powers of artificial selection, I can see no limit to the amount of change, to the beauty and infinite complexity of the co-adaptations between all organic beings, one with another, and with their physical conditions of life, which may be affected in the long course of time by nature's power of selection. Extinction. This subject will be more fully discussed in our chapter on geology, but it must be here alluded to from being intimately connected with natural selection. Natural selection acts solely through the preservation of variations in some way advantageous, which consequently endure. But as from the high geometrical powers of increase of all organic beings, each area is already fully stocked with inhabitants, it follows that as each selected and favored form increases in number, so will the less favored forms decrease and become rare. Rarity, as geology tells us, is the precursor to extinction. We can also see that any form represented by few individuals will, during fluctuations in the seasons or in the number of its enemies, run a good chance of utter extinction. But we may go further than this, for as new forms are continually and slowly being produced, unless we believe that the number of specific forms goes on perpetually and almost indefinitely increasing, numbers inevitably must become extinct. That the number of specific forms is not indefinitely increased, geology shows us plainly. And indeed, we can see reasons why they should not have thus increased, for the number of places in the polity of nature is not indefinitely great. Not that we have any means of knowing that any one region has as yet got its maximum of species. probably no region is as yet fully stocked, for, at the Cape of Good Hope, where more species of plants are crowded together than in any other quarter of the world, some foreign plants have become naturalized without causing, as far as we know, the extinction of any natives. Furthermore, the species which are most numerous in individuals will have the best chance of producing within any given period favorable variations. We have evidence of this in the facts given in the second chapter, showing that it is the common species which afford the greatest number of recorded varieties, or incipient species. Hence, rare species will be less quickly modified or improved within any given period, and they will consequently be beaten in the race for life by the modified descendants of the commoner species. From these several considerations, I think it inevitably follows that as new species in the course of time are formed through natural selection, others will become rarer and rarer, and finally extinct. The forms which stand in closest competition with those undergoing modification and improvement will naturally suffer most. And we have seen in the chapter on the struggle for existence that it is the most closely allied forms, varieties of the same species, and species of the same genus, or of related genera, which, from having nearly the same structure, constitution, and habits, generally come into the severest competition with each other. Consequently, each new variety or species, during the progress of its formation, will generally press hardest on its nearest kindred and tend to exterminate them. We see the same process of extermination amongst our domesticated productions through the selection of improved forms by man. Many curious instances could be given showing how quickly new breeds of cattle, sheep, and other animals, and varieties of flowers, take the place of older and inferior kinds. In Yorkshire, it is historically known that the ancient black cattle were displaced by the longhorns, and that these were swept away by the shorthorns. I quote the words of an agricultural writer, as if by some murderous pestilence. Divergence of character. The principle, which I have designated by this term, is of high importance on my theory, and explains, as I believe, several important facts. In the first place, varieties, even strongly marked ones, though having somewhat of the character of species, as is shown by the hopeless doubts in many cases how to rank them, yet certainly differ from each other far less than do good and distinct species. Nevertheless, according to my view, varieties are species in the process of formation, or are, as I have called them, incipient species. How then does the lesser difference between varieties become augmented into the greater differences between species? That this does habitually happen, we must infer from most of the innumerable species throughout nature presenting well-marked differences, whereas varieties, the supposed prototypes and parents of future well-marked species, present slight and ill-defined differences. Mere chance, as we may call it, might cause one variety to differ in some character from its parents, and the offspring of this variety, again, to differ from its parent in the very same character, and in a greater degree. But this alone would never account for so habitual and large an amount of difference as that between varieties of the same species and species of the same genus. As has always been my practice, let us seek light on this head from our domestic production. We shall here find something analogous. A fancier is struck by a pigeon having a slightly shorter beak. Another fancier is struck by a pigeon having a rather longer beak. And on the acknowledged principle that fanciers do not and will not admire a medium standard but like extremes, they both go on, as has actually occurred with tumbler pigeons, choosing and breeding from birds with longer and longer beaks or with shorter and shorter beaks. Again, we may suppose that at an early period, one man preferred swifter horses, another stronger and more bulky horses. The early differences would be very slight. In the course of time, from a continued selection of swifter horses by some breeders, and of stronger ones by others, the differences would become greater and would be noted as forming two sub-breeds. Finally, after the lapse of centuries, the sub-breeds would become converted into two well-established and distinct breeds. As the differences slowly become greater, the inferior animals with intermediate characters, being neither very swift nor very strong, will have been neglected and will have tended to disappear. Here, then, we see in man's productions the action of what may be called the principle of divergence, causing differences, at first barely appreciable, steadily to increase, and the breeds to diverge in character both from each other and from their common parent. But how, it may be asked, can any analogous principle apply in nature? I believe it can and does apply most efficiently, from the simple circumstance that the more diversified the descendants from any one species become in structure, constitution, and habits, by so much will they be better enabled to seize on many and widely diversified places in the polity of nature, and so be enabled to increase in numbers. We can clearly see this in the case of animals with simple habits. Take the case of a carnivorous quadruped, of which the number that can be supported in any country has long ago arrived at its full average. If its natural powers of increase be allowed to act, it can succeed in increasing, the country not undergoing any change in its conditions, only by its varying descendants seizing on places at present occupied by other animals, some of them, for instance, being enabled to feed on new kinds of prey, either dead or alive. Some inhabiting new stations, climbing trees, frequenting water, and some perhaps becoming less carnivorous. The more diversified in habits and structure the descendants of our carnivorous animal became, the more places they would be enabled to occupy. What applies to one animal will apply throughout all time to all animals, that is, if they vary, for otherwise natural selection can do nothing. So it will be with plants. It has been experimentally proved that if a plot of ground be sown with one species of grass and a similar plot be sown with several distinct genera of grasses, a greater number of plants and a greater weight of dry herbage can thus be raised. The same has been found to hold good when first one variety and then several mixed varieties of wheat have been sown on equal spaces of ground. Hence, if any one species of grass were to go on varying, and those varieties were continually selected which differed from each other in at all the same manner as distinct species and genera of grasses differ from each other, a greater number of individual plants of this species of grass, including its modified descendants, would succeed in living on the same piece of ground. And we well know that each species and each variety of grass is annually sowing almost countless seeds, and thus, as it may be said, is striving its utmost to increase its numbers. Consequently, I cannot doubt that in the course of many thousands of generations, the most distinct varieties of any one species of grass would always have the best chance of succeeding and of increasing in numbers, and thus of supplanting the less distinct varieties. And varieties, when rendered very distinct from each other, take the rank of species. The truth of the principle that the greatest amount of life can be supported by great diversification of structure is seen under many natural circumstances. In an extremely small area, especially if freely open to immigration, and where the contest between individual and individual must be severe, we always find great diversity in its inhabitants. For instance, I found that a piece of turf, 3 feet by 4 in size, which had been exposed for many years to exactly the same conditions, supported 20 species of plants, and these belonged to 18 genera and to 8 orders, which shows how much these plants differed from each other. So it is that the plants and insects on small and uniform islets, and so in small ponds of fresh water. Farmers find that they can raise most food by a rotation of plants belonging to the most different orders. Nature follows what may be called a simultaneous rotation. Most of the animals and plants which live close round any small piece of ground could live on it, supposing it not to be in any way peculiar in its nature, and may be said to be striving to the utmost to live there. But it is seen that where they come into the closest competition with each other, the advantages of diversification of structure, with the accompanying differences of habit and constitution, determine that the inhabitants, which thus jostle each other most closely, shall, as a general rule, belong to what we call different genera and orders. The same principle is seen in the naturalization of plants through man's agency in foreign lands. It might have been expected that the plants which have succeeded in becoming naturalized in any land would generally have been closely allied to the indigenes, for these are commonly looked at as specially created and adapted for their own country. It might also, perhaps, have been expected that naturalized plants would have belonged to a few groups more especially adapted to certain stations in their new homes. But the case is very different, and Alphonse de Candolle has well remarked in his great and admirable work that floras gain by naturalization proportionally with the number of the native genera and species, far more in new genera than in new species. To give a single instance, in the last edition of Dr. Asa Gray's Manual of the Flora of the Northern United States, 260 naturalized plants are enumerated, and these belong to 162 genera. We thus see that these naturalized plants are of a highly diversified nature. They differ, moreover, to a large extent from the indigenes, for out of the 162 genera, no less than 100 genera are not there indigenous, and thus a large proportional addition is made to the genera of these states. By considering the nature of the plants or animals which have struggled successfully with the indigenes of any country and have there become naturalized, we can gain some crude idea in what manner some of the natives would have had to be modified in order to have gained an advantage over the other natives. And we may, I think, at least safely infer that diversification of structure, amounting to new generic differences, would have been profitable to them. The advantage of diversification in the inhabitants of the same region is, in fact, the same as that of the physiological division of labor in the organs of the same individual body, a subject so well elucidated by Milne Edwards. No physiologist doubts that a stomach, by being adapted to digest vegetable matter alone, or flesh alone, draws most nutriment from these substances. So, in the general economy of any land, the more widely and perfectly the animals and plants are diversified for different habits of life, so will a greater number of individuals be capable of their supporting themselves. A set of animals, with their organization but little diversified, could hardly compete with a set more perfectly diversified in structure. It may be doubted, for instance, whether the Australian marsupials, which are divided into groups differing but little from each other, and feebly representing, as Mr. Waterhouse and others have remarked, our carnivorous ruminant and rodent mammals, could successfully compete with these well-pronounced orders. In the Australian mammals, we see the process of diversification in an early and incomplete stage of development. After the foregoing discussion, which ought to have been much amplified, we may, I think, assume that the modified descendants of any one species will succeed by so much the better as they become more diversified in structure and are thus enabled to encroach on places occupied by other beings. Now let us see how this principle of great benefit being derived from divergence of character, combined with the principles of natural selection and of extinction, will tend to act. The accompanying diagram will aid us in understanding this rather perplexing subject. Let A to L represent the species of a genus large in its own country. These species are supposed to resemble each other in unequal degrees, as is so generally the case in nature, and as is represented by the letters standing at unequal distances. I have said a large genus because we have seen in the second chapter that on an average more of the species of large genera vary than of small genera, and the varying species of the large genera present a greater number of varieties. We have also seen that the species, which are the commonest and the most widely diffused, vary more than rare species with restricted ranges. Let A be a common, widely diffused, and varying species belonging to a genus large in its own country. The variations are supposed to be extremely slight, but of the most diversified nature. They are not supposed all to appear simultaneously, but often after long intervals of time. Nor are they all supposed to endure for equal periods. Only those variations which are in some way profitable will be preserved or naturally selected. And here the importance of the principle of benefit being derived from divergence of character comes in. For this will generally lead to the most different or divergent variations being preserved and accumulated by natural selection. The varieties or modified descendants proceeding from the common parent will generally go on increasing in number and diverging in character. In the diagram, the process is represented up to the 10,000th generation. But I must here remark that I do not suppose that the process ever goes on so regularly as is represented in the diagram, though in itself made somewhat irregular. I am far from thinking that the most divergent varieties will invariably prevail and multiply. A medium form may often long endure, and may, or may not, produce more than one modified descendant. For natural selection will always act according to the nature of the places which are either unoccupied or not perfectly occupied by other beings. And this will depend on infinitely complex relations. But as a general rule, the more diversified in structure the descendants from any one species can be rendered, the more places they will be enabled to seize on, and the more their modified progeny will be increased. As all the modified descendants from a common and widely diffused species belonging to a large genus will tend to partake of the same advantages which made their parents successful in life, they will generally go on multiplying in number as well as diverging in character. The modified offspring from the latter and more highly improved branches in the lines of descent will, it is probable, often take the place of and so destroy the earlier and less improved branches. In some cases, I do not doubt that the process of modification will be confined to a single line of descent, and the number of the descendants will not be increased. Although the amount of divergent modification may have been increased in the successive generations. The same way, for instance, the English racehorse and the English pointer have apparently both gone on slowly diverging in character from their original stocks, without either having given off any fresh branches or races. In a large genus, it is probable that more than one species would vary. After 14,000 generations, six new species are supposed to have been produced. In each genus, the species, which are already extremely different in character, will generally tend to produce the greatest number of modified descendants, for these will have the best chance of filling new and widely different places in the polity of nature. The other nine species of our original genus may for a long period continue transmitting unaltered descendants. But during the process of modification, another of our principles, namely that of extinction, will have played an important part. As in each fully stocked country, natural selection necessarily acts by the selected form having some advantage in the struggle for life over other forms, there will be a constant tendency in the improved descendants of any one species to supplant and exterminate in each stage of descent their predecessors and their original parent. For it should be remembered that the competition will generally be most severe between those forms which are most nearly related to each other in habits, constitution, and structure. Hence, all the intermediate forms between the earlier and later states, that is, between the less and more improved state of a species, as well as the original parent species itself, will generally tend to become extinct. So it probably will be with many whole collateral lines of descent, which will be conquered by later and improved lines of descent. If, however, the modified offspring of a species get into some distinct country, or become quickly adapted to some quite new station, in which child and parent do not come into competition, both may continue to exist. But we may go further than this. The original species of our genus were supposed to resemble each other in unequal degrees, as is so generally the case in nature. Species A being more nearly related to B, C, and D than to the other species, and species I more to G, H, K, L than to the others. These two species, A and I, were also supposed to be very common and widely diffused species, so that they must originally have had some advantage over most of the other species of the genus. Their modified descendants, 14 in number at the 14,000th generation, will probably have inherited some of the same advantages. They have also been modified and improved in a diversified manner at each stage of descent, so as to have become adapted to many related places in the natural economy of their country. It seems, therefore, to me extremely probable that they will have taken the places of, and thus exterminated, not only their parents, A and I, but likewise some of the original species which were most nearly related to their parents. Hence, very few of the original species will have transmitted offspring to the 14,000th generation. We may suppose that only one of the two species which were least closely related to the other nine original species has transmitted descendants to this late stage of descent. Thus it is, as I believe, that two or more genera are produced by descent with modification from two or more species of the same genus, and the two or more parent species are supposed to have descended from some one species of an earlier genus. We have seen that in each country, it is the species of the larger genera which oftenest present varieties or incipient species. This indeed might have been expected, for as natural selection acts through one form having some advantage over other forms in the struggle for existence, it will chiefly act on those which already have some advantage. And the largeness of any group shows that its species have inherited from a common ancestor some advantage in common. Hence, the struggle for the production of new and modified descendants will mainly lie between the larger groups, which are all trying to increase in number. One large group will slowly conquer another large group, reduce its numbers, and thus lessen its chance of further variation and improvement. Within the same large group, the later and more highly perfected subgroups, from branching out and seizing on many new places in the polity of nature, will constantly tend to supplant and destroy the earlier and less improved subgroups. Small and broken groups and subgroups will finally tend to disappear. Looking to the future, we can predict that the groups of organic beings which are now large and triumphant, and which are least broken up, that is, which as yet have suffered least extinction, will for a long period continue to increase. But which groups will ultimately prevail, no man can predict, for we well know that many groups, formerly most extensively developed, have now become extinct. Looking still more remotely to the future, we may predict that, owing to the continued and steady increase of the larger groups, a multitude of smaller groups will become utterly extinct and leave no modified descendants, and consequently that of the species living at any one period, extremely few will transmit descendants to a remote futurity. I shall have to return to this subject in the chapter on classification, but I may add that on this view of extremely few of the more ancient species having transmitted descendants, and on the view of all the descendants of the same species making a class, we can understand how it is that there exist but very few classes in each main division of the animal and vegetable kingdoms. although extremely few of the most ancient species may now have living and modified descendants. Yet, at the most remote geological period, the Earth may have been as well peopled with many species of many genera, families, orders, and classes as of the present day. Summary of chapter. If, during the long course of ages and under varying conditions of life, organic beings vary at all in the several parts of their organization, and I think this cannot be disputed, if there be, owing to the high geometrical powers of increase of each species, at some age, season, or year, a severe struggle for life, and this certainly cannot be disputed, then, considering the infinite complexity of the relations of all organic beings to each other and to their conditions of existence, causing an infinite diversity in structure, constitution, and habits to be advantageous to them, I think it would be a most extraordinary fact if no variation ever had occurred useful to each being's own welfare, in the same way as so many variations have occurred useful to man. But if variations useful to any organic being do occur, assuredly individuals thus characterized will have the best chance of being preserved in the struggle for life. And from the strong principle of inheritance, they will tend to produce offspring similarly characterized. This principle of preservation I have called, for the sake of brevity, natural selection. Natural selection on the principles of qualities being inherited at corresponding ages can modify the egg, seed, or young as easily as the adult. Amongst many animals, sexual selection will give its aid to ordinary selection by assuring to the most vigorous and best adapted males the greatest number of offspring. Sexual selection will also give characters useful to the males alone in their struggles with other males. Whether natural selection has really thus acted in nature, in modifying and adapting the various forms of life to their several conditions and stations, must be judged of by the general tenor and balance of evidence given in the following chapters. But we already see how it entails extinction, and how largely extinction has acted in the world's history, geology plainly declares. Natural selection also leads to divergence of character. For more living beings can be supported on the same area, the more they diverge in structure, habits, and constitution, of which we see proof by looking at the inhabitants of any small spot or at naturalized production. Therefore, during the modification of the descendants of any one species, and during the incessant struggle of all species to increase in numbers, the more diversified these descendants become, the better will be their chance of succeeding in the battle of life. Thus, the small differences distinguishing varieties of the same species will steadily tend to increase till they come to equal the greater differences between species of the same genus or even of distinct genera. We have seen that it is the common, the widely diffused, and widely ranging species belonging to the larger genera, which vary most, and these will tend to transmit to their modified offspring that superiority which now makes them dominant in their own countries. Natural selection, as has just been remarked, leads to divergence of character and to much extinction of the less improved and intermediate forms of life. On these principles, I believe, the nature of the affinities of all organic beings may be explained. It is a truly wonderful fact, the wonder of which we are apt to overlook from familiarity, that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space should be related to each other in group, subordinate to group, in the manner which we everywhere behold, namely, varieties of the same species most closely related together, species of the same genus less closely and unequally related together, forming sections and subgenera, species of distinct genera much less closely related, and genera related in different degrees, forming subfamilies, families, orders, subclasses, and classes. The several subordinate groups in any class cannot be ranked in a single file, but seem rather to be clustered round points, and these round other points, and so on, in almost endless cycles. On the view that each species has been independently created, I can see no explanation of this great fact in the classification of all organic beings. But, to the best of my judgment, it is explained through inheritance on the complex action of natural selection, entailing extinction and divergence of character, as we have seen illustrated. The affinities of all the beings of the same class have sometimes been represented by a great tree. I believe this simile largely speaks the truth. The green and budding twigs may represent existing species, and those produced during each former year may represent the long succession of extinct species. At each period of growth, all the growing twigs have tried to branch out on all sides and to overtop and kill the surrounding twigs and branches. In the same manner as species and groups of species have tried to overmaster other species in the great battle for life. The limbs divided into great branches, and these into lesser and lesser branches, were themselves once, when the tree was small, budding twigs. And this connection of the former and present buds by ramifying branches may well represent the classification of all extinct and living species in groups subordinate to groups. Of the many twigs which flourished when the tree was a mere bush, only two or three, now grown into great branches, yet survive and bear all the other branches. So, with the species which lived during long past geological periods, very few now have living and modified descendants. From the first growth of the tree, many a limb and branch has decayed and dropped off, and these lost branches of various sizes may represent those whole orders, families, and genera which have now no living representatives, and which are known to us only from having been found in a fossil state. As we here and there see a thin, straggling branch springing from a fork low down in a tree, and which by some chance has been favored and is still alive on its summit, so we occasionally see an animal like the Ornithorhynchus or Lepidosiren, which in some small degree connects by its affinities two large branches of life, and which has apparently been saved from fatal competition by having inhabited a protected session. As buds give rise by growth to fresh buds, and these, if vigorous, branch out and overtop on all sides many a feebler branch, so, by generation, I believe it has been with the great tree of life, which fills with its dead and broken branches the crust of the earth, and covers the surface with its ever-branching and beautiful ramifications.